Oder to continue the short demo of the tool support for this approach. And let's see. Okay, so there I try to enlarge the type so you can actually read it. So there's a web interface for that. For the tool support, you can see the address in the top if you're interested, and you need a password. You can just write it down. The password is participant. No, sorry, tool user. And no, sorry, that's the username, and the password is I may use this. Let's see. Like that. So, well, anyway, if you want to use it later and you don't get to write this down now, you can always write an email or something. Okay, let's see. So there's some explanation on this web page, and in particular, a couple of small tutorials for the different analysis plugins. So this is one that I wanted to show here. So this is this secure links check, which we saw earlier, and with XML here just means that one can also define one's own default attacker, one's own attacker models in an XML format, in addition to providing the UML model. And this looks like that. So this is the example for this default adversary model, which we've already seen, but one can also define other kinds of adversary models. And so, yeah, you just have to give the name of this adversary model, and then you can define for different kinds of stereotypes that may be attached to communication links or to system nodes in the deployment diagram. You can define different threads such as delete, read, insert, and so on. So this is really just what I explained earlier. And yes, then one has to have such an adversary model stored on one's computer. So I will just save it. Actually, I already did this when I just tried it in the break, but anyway, just do it again. And then, okay, and then you can create a UML model, for example, using, well, we always use the UML tool Poseidon, which also has a freely available community edition, so it's the base version, which is freely available. Well, I don't have the time to actually create the UML model now, but well, you can draw a diagram such as this one here. This is a deployment diagram where again you have different kinds of communication links and communication dependencies here, and this secure links requirements is then supposed to check that this is consistent. This is just the UML diagram, and this is how this looks in Poseidon. So this, you can only see a part here now because the diagram is too large. But in particular here, well, in the model, sorry, in the bottom, one can then define the tags and so on. Okay, and if we well, let's just assume that we created this and stored this on the computer. And okay, so then the next step is that one can call this UMLSec tool, which was there was a link at the bottom of the first page which we just saw, at the bottom of this, to the new web interface. And so there are different kinds of checks one can perform after uploading this kind of file, which was created by this, for example, by this Poseidon tool. So this is now, this has Targo as an ending instead of XMI, because it's a zipped file which contains also an XMI file, but also other data. But that's not so important. Now, one can also upload just the plain XMI file to the tool. Anyway, now one can upload this here, and there are different checks one can perform corresponding to the different kinds of stereotypes. So the one we want to check is now the static check, which does the static consistency checks such as secure links, secure dependencies, and so on. And then click submit. Now it takes a while because the UML model has to be uploaded over the web and loaded into this MDR framework, and then. We can now, as part of these static checks, there are different things one can check, namely secure links, secure dependency, we saw that, and gulp access, we've also seen that, and there are other things we didn't look at just now. And in particular, this secure links with XML, where one can also define one's own adversary model. So submit, and then we have to upload the adversary model, which in this case was simply the default adversary, but one could also could have done something else there. And again submit, and there should be a result now in the bottom. This is now sort of the text report that one would get back. I mean, there are still some internal information in there for our purposes, because this is still an academic prototype, and this would probably be removed if this really wasn't supposed to be used in an industrial context. For example, we can see here there are 5 dependencies in the model, which each of which does not have a name attached to it. So in principle, one can give names to dependencies, but this was not the case here. And there you also get a list of the different stereotypes of the dependencies. And it then turns out that with respect to the secure links check, which we just performed, the UML model violates the requirement. And in fact, there are 2 places where it is violated. And so this gives us this information, and then one can also download a version of the UML diagram where this is pointed out in more detail. And let's see. So this is really, that's what it says here. Okay. And then there are also other checks one can perform. Let's see. I guess this is really what I wanted to show here. There are also the other checks and also tutorials for these other checks, but the principle is always the same. So one has to create a UML model, for example, using this tool, Poseidon or some other UML tool, and then upload it into the over the web interface, and then maybe choose the check to be performed here, and then you get back the result and possibly a UML model where the problems are pointed out. But I guess I don't have to explain all of these, but I mean, if you're interested, you can just have a look at the web interface. Okay, I just wanted to shortly demonstrate that. Now, coming back to the presentation. Yeah, because there was a question about that, I just want to shortly explain how this security analysis works. As I demonstrated, so some of these checks refer to an adversary model, which represents what an adversary could really do against a given system, depending on the threat scenarios that arise from the deployment diagram. And so this analysis methods on the whole go back to a rather long-standing research in formal methods applied to security. There was one influential paper in 82 by Dolev and Yao, where they proposed this kind of analysis method to analyze cryptographic protocols for correctness. And the idea is to look at the cryptographic protocol at a relatively high degree of abstraction, so one does not want to model or to analyze the cryptographic algorithms on the bit sequence level, because that would not be feasible usually, at least not in an automated way. And the goal of this approach is really to have it automated to the extent that, as I just demonstrated, a user can draw a diagram in a UML case tool and can upload it into the web interface, and then automatically get back some kind of result. For this to be possible in an automated way, this is not usually not possible if you want to perform these verifications on the bit sequence level. So we have to define what exactly the attacker is supposed to be doing. So the attacker may take part in the system execution and may know some data in advance and may read messages that are exchanged on the network, that the network paths are accessible to the adversary, and also inject messages in certain parts of the network. As I mentioned already, there may be different kinds of adversary types that may be able to access different kinds of parts of the system. And yeah, this is what I just said. So we look at cryptographic algorithms and cryptographic keys on a rather abstract level, where these are just seen as symbols and these algorithms just as abstract functions. And these are the assumptions that we impose there, so we can make this analysis. And again, there are some attacks which you cannot detect that way, such as statistical traffic analysis. But yeah, that would not be feasible in this kind of automated approach. But the point is that you can still get many attacks. As I said already, and as we saw already on one of the slides, although we didn't look at that very closely, one can use in the UML specification make use of these cryptographic algorithms, which are now viewed as atomic operations in this kind of abstract function world. And so this is sort of how this is formally defined. So you can have these cryptographic expressions are built up from variables, keys, and data using concatenation, encryption, decryption, and so on. And you have to impose certain equations, such as if you encrypt something under a key and you decrypt it with the corresponding decryption key, then you get back the original expression, and similar for signature and extraction from a signature. But otherwise, it's assumed that only the equations that follow from these equations and similar equations for concatenation and unfolding concatenation hold in this term algebra and no other equations. And this is something you have to assume, because otherwise the cryptographic algorithms themselves may not be secure. But that's we would just assume that the cryptographic algorithms themselves are secure, because that's what people in cryptography have to worry about. And then what I just said about this adversary model, you could view, you could visualize this in this kind of way, where the adversary sits between two participants or two parts of the system, assuming that this communication link is accessible by the adversary and can do certain things to the interaction there. Okay, there I actually wanted to have an animation, I think. So now, assuming that you have a situation where there are two components, for example, a client and a server in a protocol, which are connected by A and B, and which are connected by a communication link, which is under control of the adversary, because, for example, it may be an internet link. And we assume that the adversary has this initial knowledge K minus 1, which is the private key of the adversary, and some data value y. And then the protocol starts when A wants to send the message M with argument x to B, but unfortunately, without necessarily A knowing, there's the adversary sitting in the middle, so the message is actually sent to the adversary. And then the adversary may or may not send on the message to B. But firstly, the adversary gets to know this argument which is communicated there. So this is added to this adversary knowledge down here, where one should note that this is only sort of the generating set of the adversary knowledge. Of course, the adversary now also knows the signature of Y using the signature key K minus 1 and the concatenation of Y and X and so on. So the adversary can also apply all these operations which I defined on the previous slide, provided he has the necessary data such as secret keys and so on. In the next step, the adversary decides to simply forward the message to B as was intended by A, but of course he would not be forced to do that at all. But assuming that he does that, then B firstly evaluates this condition here, and while well, this artificial example B simply checks whether this argument is really X, and if this is the case, then B returns some other expression in this example, namely the value Z encrypted under the key K. And of course, B again intends to return this to A, but again there's the adversary sitting in the middle and catching the message, and therefore the adversary also gets this expression Z encrypted under K. And since in the previous slide I imposed this equation that, as I explained, if you encrypt something under a key and you decrypt it under the corresponding secret key, you get back the result. The adversary can do this here with Z encrypted under K and the corresponding decryption key K minus 1, and then also gets this expression Z in his set of knowledge. And finally, the adversary now decides, instead of forwarding the expression as received by B, forwards this a different expression, namely concatenation of Y and X encrypted under Z. So this is just an artificial example to explain how this bit could go. And so now to analyze the specification for the security requirements by including this abstract adversary model. In order to analyze this now, we can, for example, keep track of the knowledge set of the adversary. So we saw that on the previous slide in the bottom. Namely, this is sort of the set given in the bottom here. So this is the adversary knowledge set, or part of it rather, and this is what we want to keep track of in order, for example, to find out whether the adversary gets to know a secret value during the execution of the system. And so therefore we call the initial knowledge of the adversary of type A, we write this as K0A, and there's something missing. I guess this is, this was a symbol representing the set which is generated by the set of knowledge at the step N, by adding the messages that the adversary receives in the next step, and by applying these operations that the adversary can apply. So this is just what we saw on the example on the previous slide. And then one can define, again going back to this Solovyov approach, that a system specification keeps the secrecy of a message M against attackers of type A if they exist in the sequence of knowledge sets after each iteration of the system. There exists no such knowledge set such that the adversary or this value M is contained in this set. If that's not the case, then the secrecy of M is preserved. And a couple of examples here. So if assuming that we have an adversary who can only read messages, then in this example the secrecy of M and K is not preserved, because firstly the adversary can simply read K, and can then secondly use K to decrypt, assuming this is in symmetric encryption, to decrypt this expression, and then also get M. But this specification, if we assume that this is complete in the sense that the participants don't otherwise publish K, then the security of M is, or the secrecy of M is preserved in this situation here. And in this example, if we consider an active adversary who is able to delete and insert messages in the network, then the security of M is not preserved, because although all messages that are exchanged are actually encrypted, and although the adversary does not know the decryption key that corresponds to the public encryption key of B, what the adversary can do is simply to delete this message from the network and instead forward his own key to B, encrypted under the public key of D. And then B will return M encrypted of under the encryption key that the adversary sent to B earlier, and then the adversary can decrypt that that message. But the security or the secrecy of M is in fact preserved against adversaries who can only read and not insert messages on this network. Okay, and then well, I don't think I actually have enough time to explain this in detail, but I just want to mention that there is, if you wonder now how to deal with this in the context of the tool support, which I shortly demonstrated just now, there is a way of coding this up into first order logic. Firstly, by defining or a predicate knows, which represents the knowledge that the adversary may gain throughout the execution of the system. And then secondly, one can just check whether one can derive knows of S from the formulas that are generated from a given specification. So we implemented a way or an algorithm which, for example, from a sequence diagram, generates a set of first order logic formula, and the question is whether from these formula you can then derive that knows of S knows. If that's the case, then this means that the adversary may get to know the secret S, and if not, then the secret will actually remain secret. And for that, you can use different tools to check whether you can derive this. Either use Prolog, which is quite suited for that, or there are also more specialized automated theorem provers, such as the ZTO prover, which has been developed in Munich also. I don't want to explain this in detail, but I just want to say that, okay, these cryptographic expressions which I explained, they will, in this translation, they will be translated to this kind of formula, which represents what the adversary can do with these expressions, namely putting them together or taking apart expressions, provided he has enough knowledge about them. And secondly, again, this example which we saw earlier which we now see in a bit more detail. So this is consists of two components connected by an internet link, and in particular there's the secret S, which is supposed to be communicated from the client to the server, and it's actually supposed to remain secret there. And okay, there's some coordination, so each the client and server will each be iterated independently. And this is then the behavior of the protocol as defined in a sequence diagram. So it's just a rather short protocol consisting of just three messages back and forth between the client and the server, containing each some of these cryptographic expressions, which I just explained. And here there are some conditions which have to hold so that the execution will continue at that point. And then there is a translation of the sequence diagram like that into a formula by translating each of the lines in the diagram, which can be seen as, well, you have a condition depending on the previous execution of the protocol, and if the condition is fulfilled, then a new message will be sent out. So each line of the protocol of this sequence diagram can be seen in this way as such an expression, and each such expression is then translated to such a formula, and these will all be packed up into each other. So it's a sort of iterative definition. And using this formula, one can then again check whether you can derive these this nodes of S from the formulas you generated from this diagram, and this will then be an approximation of the adversity logic from above, meaning that if you can derive nodes of S, then there may be an attack, and if you cannot, then you are sure that this kind of attack does not exist. But you may have false positives, which is necessarily evil in this sense, because in general security properties are undecidable. So if you want to have an automated way of verifying them, then you will always have some false positives or something, because otherwise it won't be completely automated since it's undecidable. So the sequence diagram gets translated into a formula, where here there's a fragment shown, but it's a bit longer than that, but not too bad actually. And then, yeah, one can show using this tool that actually, given this previous knowledge of the adversary, well, just meaning that he has his own public-private key pair, which is reasonable to assume, one can actually derive nodes of S. And this actually means that the secrecy of this secret is actually not preserved. And this, the attack can be visualized like this. So there's an adversary in the middle, again, as we saw before, which forwards some of the messages, but other messages he does not forward exactly other message part, but instead, for example, pens his own public key and his own signature to the server, and the other way around. And this way he can then decrypt the session key, which is exchanged, and then using the session key you can also get to the secret. And then, well, after we found that, we could actually repair the protocol, which wasn't actually so difficult. You only need to insert another value in the signature at this point. So the fact that the correct protocol and the incorrect protocol are really almost the same, except for this little value, which is just the public key of the client, which is being sent back and which seems to have no real purpose if you look at it from not too closely, because C already knows this public key, of course. But anyway, that's the interesting thing about these security protocols is that the previous protocol was actually completely insecure, and this one you can actually be shown to be secure in this sense. And that's what makes these kind of protocols so interesting, maybe, and so difficult. Okay, yeah, we could then show this using the tool support. Okay, and in this I really cannot explain in detail now. Anyway, so the idea is here that simply that using this approach you can also define secure channel abstractions, and you can show once and for all that such a secure channel which is implemented using a particular protocol is actually secure, and then you can use it in the context of your system development. Yeah, but I cannot expand it in detail here. okay, we had the demo already. And now I can with the last coffee break in half an hour, I could either give more examples about the security stuff, such as this Java security, or I could go more quickly to the safety part. I don't know what you're more interested in. More security or the safety thing? Safety, okay. Then, yeah, we'll just skip to these things. But this is just an example for using Java security architecture things. And okay, just maybe mention some of the examples in the security part. We've applied this to a web application which was being developed by a large German bank, where they had their own security protocol developed and running on top of the SSL protocol, because they somehow needed some extra security requirement which was not provided by that version of SSL they were using. And this we analyzed using this approach. And also something else we did was to analyze access control configuration of SAP business systems. And we're currently looking at a biometric authentication protocol for the German telecom, and also an automatic telematic application for a German car manufacturer. So there are quite a few industrial applications already. And I will also skip through this, I think, for time reason. Yeah, just show that there are some basic security engineering principles which you can also use this approach to enforce them. And if you're interested, you can have a look at that and on the slides on the web. Okay, something else I just want to mention shortly is that you can also use this approach. I mean, so far I mainly concentrated on the more analysis part, but you can also use it in a more synthetic way. By using a sort of pattern-based approach. So patterns are more generally a recent hype almost to use in systems development, where you want to use of some established solution for a well-known problem. There are a couple of books written on these kind of patterns, design patterns, and also now a book written on security patterns. And so the question is whether you can use this kind of patterns also in the context of this model-based development. And this is actually the case. And in the case of in the situation here, the application of a pattern then is essentially a transformation of one UML model to another UML model. So a function from UML models to UML models. So this is what applying a pattern is on a technical sense here. And for example, going back to this example of this account balance, this would, the pattern, there's a pattern which makes this insecure example secure by adding another kind of component to the system. And so the application of the pattern would then be to take this kind of diagram and to produce a new diagram which then contains this other component as well, and modifies the earlier component in the way that in this example the access to that other component is controlled by this wrapper object. And this is the general pattern, the general idea of applying patterns. And similarly, this works with the secure channel pattern, which I mentioned already. So, in the situation where you say, I want to have an encrypted communication link. This is transformed to a model with more detail, where you actually have a security protocol which sets up a session key which lets you encrypt your communication. So this is, would be this bank application case study in more detail, but we don't have the time to discuss this now. And that's another application which I just want to mention shortly. That's a electronic purse standard which is currently being developed by Visa International and other companies. And the idea is that you or use electronic purses implemented on smart cards in order to be able to perform electronic transactions, or also to use them instead of cash in the shop. And the idea is that they are supposed to be more secure than credit cards, because you can reuse a credit card number, at least in a phone transaction or internet transaction, in another transaction. And in particular, an adversary can do that, of course. Whoever gets to know your credit card number, for example, the merchant that you tell the credit card number on the phone and who writes it down or memorizes it, whatever, can of course reuse that in another transaction. And this is, of course, highly insecure. And this is what they want to change with this smart card-based architecture. And this, well, I cannot explain this in detail, but we had to look at two of the main protocols in that that system. We specified that using this dual main sec notation, and we thought about what would be the threat scenarios there and how to check them. So there are security conditions here which you have to check, and we used our tool support to actually find out that there's actually a flaw in this specification. So there are, in the sense that in the specification document, there is a certain statement made about part of the protocol, part of the data that is exchanged, namely that a certain signature is supposed to be a proof for the fact that the loading machine received a cash from the cardholder and is supposed to forward the cash to the bank. But unfortunately, the signature does not actually constitute a valid proof, because the bank could also construct it themselves. And this is something we also could find with this approach. But there's a fix for that, which we could also verify. And this I already mentioned, these applications. Now I will then come to the safety part. So firstly, I have to say a bit about some terminology here. There's always these different kinds of aspects between safety, reliability, dependability, and so on, which are sort of interlinked but not quite the same. So when I say, this is an extension for safety critical systems, then I say that because the aim is to use them, for example, to develop systems that are safety critical, and that, but of course the goal is to make them more reliable, right? I mean, if I have a safety critical system, then I usually want it to be reliable. I mean, this is the connection between safety and reliability. And I mean, for someone who's really from the security area as opposed to safety, it's always a bit puzzling that there's so much discussion there. I mean, of course, safe systems should be reliable, because otherwise I have a problem. I mean, otherwise they won't be safe. But of course, I mean, on a technical level, there are two different things. Safety is about not harming anyone, and reliability is about being able to rely on that the system is supposed to be doing what it should do. But in that sense, of course, I could have a reliable, I could consider a reliable system which is not safety critical. in that sense, they are really different, but if I worry about such ecological systems, then they should probably be reliable. And in that sense, the requirements that I will talk about in this part of the tutorial are probably really more reliability requirements, but I want to use them for safety critical systems, so that's why I said it's a safety extension. So reliability is then probability of a failure-free functioning of a software component for a specified period in a specified environment. That's sort of the technical definition. And as opposed to safety, which is the software execution without contributing to hazards. And then different kinds of things may go wrong. You may have faults or failures. Again, this there's a sort of distinction where faults are the possible cause of failures, and these faults may contain in hardware, code, or other artifacts. Whereas failures are the perceived deviation of output values from the expected values, and so it's always a relative thing. Whatever you consider reliable or what you consider a failure is always relative to what you wanted to the system to do in the first place. Another thing which stands this terminology maybe on the next couple of slides, maybe sometimes a bit blurred, is that, again, this is sort of relative. I mean, if you say a fault is a cause of a failure, then, of course, this failure may be the cause for another failure. And then, of course, you could also say, well, then the failure is also a fault or something. I mean, so that distinction in that sense, I think it's also a bit relative. And so that for that reason, I sometimes only talk about failures, whereas some of these failures would more technically precise probably be called faults. But generally, when I say failure, I say something is going wrong, whether this is on the hardware level because there's a persistent flaw in the hardware, or whether this is a software bug, or whether there's something which is caused by a software or a hardware bug, and which nevertheless something which behaves in a way that it's not supposed to behave. For safety critical systems, one has different failure condition categories. So the worst thing would be that there could be catastrophic effects, and then there are less catastrophic effects such as hazardous, major, minor, or even no effect. And correspondingly, you are also in some standards have safety levels, such as the safety levels A to E in the EU 178B standard. And many of these safety goals are then specified with respect to the maximum allowed failure rate. Although, of course, this is really more reliability. And again, here the distinction is a bit blurred. So, of course, well, again, if you consider an airplane, for example, it should be reliable in the sense that the maximum allowed failure rate is maybe like something like one failure in 1,000 years. And because otherwise you have a safety problem, because if there are humans flying on the plane, then because they would usually die if the plane crashes. So that's again the connection between reliability and safety. And the point here is that there are high degrees of safety or reliability if it's really safety critical in the sense of that human lives are involved, and the reliability restrictions are so high that you only allow like one failure in 1,000 years, then it's usually, this is actually usually formulated in a different way. You say the failure rate per hour is, I think, 10 to the minus 9 would be the same figure, which amounts to one failure in 100,000 years if you just, multiply, compute how many years are 10 to the 9 hours. And if you look at it in that way, then it should be sort of obvious that it's difficult to establish this by testing, because of course you cannot do this do the testing for 100,000 years. And also, you probably don't have 100,000 identical machines which you can use for testing for 1 year each in order to achieve the same effect. So this doesn't work, and that's why in these areas people have already been applying sort of analysis or even formal verification methods in order to establish that whether this high reliability requirement is actually fulfilled. And this is also why it makes sense to use a sort of model-based approach in this context, because again, you can here also perform complete analysis of the models that you consider. And another comparison to testing is that in testing you usually cannot consider the whole state space of the system, especially with reactive systems. You can only choose a representative set of the possible executions of the system, and if you are unlucky, then the failures are in the set which you did not select. And this is also different on the model level, because the models are more abstract. You can analyze them in a complete way, at least with respect to certain requirements. And okay, then in order to establish or to enforce these kind of high degrees of reliability, given that hardware does fail for physical reasons, the standard technique here is using fault tolerance mechanisms, and there you have a certain redundancy model which determines which level of redundancy you want to use in order to provide this high level of reliability which you need. And then the goal is to have no errors in presence of single point failures, meaning that of course if you use redundancy in the sense that you have different copies of a certain component which compute the same value, and then you have a voting of what should actually be the end result, then this will not work, of course, if all copies of the component fail at the same time. Then you're out of luck, of course. And that's why we say, okay, no errors in presence of single point failures, and otherwise, okay, that's bad luck. But it should be very improbable that this happens at the same time to the different copies. Although, of course, there are some subtleties there. If the failure goes down to a sort of a software failure or a design fault, then having different copies of the same thing, all of which have the same fault, doesn't really help you a lot. But this is really not the content of the talk, but there are a lot of strategies here. The goal here is more that to establish an approach which allows you to use, for example, these redundancy mechanisms correctly within the system context. So this is what the following couple of slides will be about. And as an example, I will mainly focus on these fault tolerance aspects of constructing reliable systems, again, with a view towards safety. And one important application domain for this is that of embedded software, such as, for example, in the automotive or avionics domain or aeronautics and so on. This is also our intended application here. So especially in the automotive area, where we have long-standing collaborations with car manufacturers in Germany. And okay, yeah, I explained this already, faults and failures and how you have to distinguish them. And this is always, failures are always relative to the requirements you have. Now to compare these two different extensions, well, it's interesting to note that well, there are actually some parallels, some of which I already mentioned, in the sense that well, you could view safety or safety or reliability and on the one hand, and security on the other hand, as sort of the two different ends of the same scale, saying that well, in fact, the comparison between safety and security is well, it's a bit under discussion. I mean, there, for example, in the German section of the German Computer Society, which is conveniently called in with the German name for safety, which is the same as for security. Interestingly enough, there, because of that, that aspect of the German language, we were forced to have some discussion about what we really mean if we say Sicherheit, which is the German word both for safety and for security. In English, you either say safety or you say security, and then you know what you mean. In German, you don't always know what you mean, which is sometimes a bit confusing. And this is also why we are having still now an ongoing discussion about the differences and comparison between safety and security. And interestingly enough, the security people view this from a different angle than the safety people. So if I make this comparison here, then this is probably more the security point of view, because security people would say that, okay, in safety or in reliable systems, the difference to security is that in security you look at motivated adversaries that may act themselves in a willful way, such as humans, for example, whereas in safety you worry on reliable systems, you worry about failures, which usually are not intended, but happen maybe even in a random way. If you have hardware that fails randomly, which of course is also not always the case, it may also be a design fault, but anyway, it's something which is usually not intended. And then if you look at it that way, then you could say, okay, safety is security against stupid adversaries. So adversaries who do things wrong, but they don't intend to, and they don't necessarily, you know, try to find the best way of attacking the system. And the difference there is that in safety critical or reliable systems, it actually makes sense to make requirements which refer to probabilities, saying that well, with a high probability, nothing goes wrong, or the system behaves in the way that it's supposed to behave. Whereas in security, it's not so clear whether this makes sense, because if the system, if there's a certain probability that the system does something which lets someone exploit this this flaw, then and if the adversary is in the position to actually get to that point where this situation arises, then you will have to assume that the adversary does get the system to the point. So even though this is only one possible execution out of many executions, if the adversary is motivated enough, he will find this execution and will make the system go that execution path, and it doesn't help you that it's only one out of many executions. While in safety or in reliable systems, you would say, okay, if it's only one execution out of 10 million, then the probability is very little that this will happen. Of course, again, this is a sort of simplifying view, and you may have different or similar problems in reliable systems as well. Again, coming back to design flaws or things like that. But in principle, this could be the distinction. Although people from safety, the safety area, usually see another distinction, namely that well, safety is about protecting the environment from the system, whereas in security, it's more that you want to protect the system from its environment. Although even also that is not quite true, because you also have a sort of a gray area in between. So in general, one could say that both aspects are really similar and they are overlapping and sometimes also conflicting. I mean, there are some security requirements which are in conflict to reliability or safety requirements, and so it would be interesting to have more of a look at the interactions between the different kinds of fields here. Although one has to say that in the past, this the two communities were rather distinct, actually. Although in the dependability community, people view security as just one aspect of security. The security people usually think of themselves as something else. You know, it's sort of a community thing. Anyway, so that's the general comparison. And if you look at it this way, then you can now define a reliable systems or safety critical systems extension of UML by, instead of considering adversary models, now consider failure models and analyze the system specification to what extent the redundancy mechanisms that are used in the system actually are able to make the system execute reliably instead of the faults that may arise. Compared, which is similar to the situation security, where you want to make sure that the system executes securely in the presence of the adversary. So, and similarly to what we had to do in the security extension, one now has to look at the execution semantics of these UML models, because many reliability requirements are formulated with respect to the execution of the system. So firstly, again, one has to define and or make use of the execution semantics of this fragment of UML. But secondly, one also would like to again include on the level of the UML model certain information or certain characteristics about, on the one hand, the physical layer of the system, and on the other hand, in this case, the redundancy mechanisms that are supposed to be used in the system. And so there are, you can consider different kinds of failure semantics, such as crash performance or value failure semantics, and then you can consider different kinds of redundancy models, and then for each failure semantics and redundancy model, you get a set of possible failures, and here we now concentrate on the failures that may occur with respect to data that is communicated between different components in the system. And there you may have at least three different kinds of failures, namely the data may be delayed by a certain time, maximum time delay, and secondly, the data may get lost completely, and here the parameter p is the probability that the value is not delivered within the maximum time delay, and again, we just say that it's supposed to be lost. If it arrives too late, then we cannot make any use of it anymore. And thirdly, what can happen is that a certain data value gets corrupted with a certain probability. So more exactly, that the value which is delivered in time is in fact corrupted. And in each case, after incorporating the redundancy model with respect to the communication link, which initially has a certain failure semantics.
So it's not defining already defining the SPT profile, or your works are based on
in the this UML extension, and not in that way. So there are different UML extensions which allow you to also include certain quality of service requirements. So they may also have something about maximum time delays. This was sort of developed independently of that that extension. But what they don't have is this analysis framework. So it would be interesting to see how to merge the two approaches. That's true. So what they don't have is what I will explain in the next couple of slides. And that's, yeah, so firstly, an example. Suppose that that we have a redundancy model where a certain controller in the system is used with redundancy 3, meaning that there are three copies of the controller which are executed in parallel, and that of these three, then the fastest result will be taken in the further execution. Then these three values, which we mentioned in the previous slide, have the following parameters. Firstly, T is then the delay of the fastest controller, because whoever gets done first, the result will be used, and that's then by definition the maximum time delay. And if we set a certain T in there, then T, or a certain value for T, then T will be the probability that this fastest result is not delivered within T. Yes?
Does it make the sense to me that the fastest result will be used? Because if you have three redundancy, you have to compare the three results before you do any action.
Yeah, I mean, there are different redundancy mechanisms, and there are different ways of voting about them. So here, this is an example, and you could consider other kinds of examples. The assumption is that you assume that the controllers work correctly, but they may be too slow. And if you, this is of course an example only. Okay. You have other examples where the controllers don't work correctly or whatever, but just to explain how these values should be computed.
You talked about corrupt service.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So in that sense, it's maybe not a good example, because the probability will be zero here. Anyways, it's just an example, and of course there are other situations where you actually want to compare the results and then take a majority vote or something like that. And you could also model it in this framework. But here just gives this as an example.
And I don't quite understand what the difference between delay and loss is. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, delay means that it will be after T.
Yes.
And loss.
Well, loss is relative to the delay, saying that delay is just a time span which I can impose as a developer.
So delay is not a failure. It's just a specification of the
delay. No, it's not necessarily a failure, exactly.
But why is it in the list of failures?
That's a technical reason, because this is, failures is not a good name for that. I mean, these are properties of the links or the nodes that are attached with the stereotype test. So, failures, good question.
So it's not a failure. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.